Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk from the Scottish Book Trust. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. And what a pleasure it is to be back in your ears. We've got a great podcast for you today. We're going to be talking to John Gordon Sinclair about his latest novel, Blood Whispers. And we'll also be talking to Mikey Cudahy about the idea of happiness. But first, on our previous episode, we had a conversation about Patrick Ness's book, More Than This. The one person that was missing from that conversation was Patrick Ness. But we've got him on the podcast today. Here's Sacha de Boule in conversation with Patrick Ness about the book More Than This.
My name is Patrick Ness. I'm the author of a bunch of YA books, and my latest is called More Than This.
Could you tell us a little bit about the new book?
It's about a boy called Seth who in the first 2.5 pages drowns and dies unambiguously, and then he wakes up somewhere. And the mystery first is, where is he, and then why he's gotten to this particular place, what it means, what it's... it's a mystery book. Let's leave it at that. I don't want to give anything else away.
Something that we noticed about the book is that it feels almost genreless at times. Mm-hmm. Like it's just very bare and clean and minimalist. Did that evolve naturally when you were writing it, or was it intentional?
Well, I don't know if I'd say genreless. I would hopefully say more sort of genre open. Okay. That it's happy to embrace... Mm-hmm. All kinds of things. And that's a purposeful writing thing, is I always tell people that spite is a really good place to write from, that it's a really good motivator from people telling you you can't do something. Mm-hmm. And so, you stick two fingers up and you say, watch me. And so I do that even for positive reasons. I love genre stuff. I mm-hmm. Feel no snobbery about genre things, but I also don't want I want to use whatever the story needs. And so yeah. I'll happily take a sci-fi element or a thriller element or a realistic element and use it however the story needs. The story can do anything, so why not let it do anything? So I prefer genre open.
And actually, creating a book that uses those genres in a positive way but isn't limiting can really open it up to a bigger audience.
I think so too. And because the great thing about teenage readers in particular is that they're not snobs.
Yeah.
And they're happy to cross genres all the time. And what a gift for a writer.
I know. Yeah. You can just do anything.
Yeah.
Eat it up.
You have to respect them. It has to be a good story. But they're more open-minded about where you could go with that story, which is great.
So obviously, More Than This is a young adult novel, but you also write for regular adults.
is that the difference?
Young versus
regular. Yeah.
How did you decide that it was going to be for teens? Was it the fact that it was so genre open, or did you?
No, I mean it's always the story that tells you. Or tells me rather. To say that you know it when you see it isn't really satisfactory. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think. I've thought about this a lot because I get asked about it a lot, but I think the difference might be that a book for teenagers tends to be about finding your boundaries and pushing okay. against them, mm. crossing them, making mistakes, finding out, to what level do you exist and how yeah. solid are those boundaries. And adult books tend to be about a life lived inside those boundaries mm-hmm. and how those boundaries might confine and how they might be wrong. So that's a slight difference, and I think that might be the difference. But the boundaries are hugely porous and it's a continuum, it's not a dividing line, so I don't know. it feels like a teenage novel, so it probably is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Would you say that in order to sort of push against those boundaries, you actively choose to include the sort of dark themes that you generally have in your young adult books? So for example, this book has a really recurring theme of suicide.
Yeah.
It's explored pretty harshly.
I don't, not on purpose. I mean, I don't set out to write about an issue, and I don't mm-hmm. set out to certainly not preach, because then it's a sermon, it's not a story. A story has to come first. Basically, my primary writing philosophy, which is the story has to come first. It must. Even if the concerns are good ones, even if they're for good reasons. Monster Calls is a good example. Mm-hmm. The temptation would have been to write a tribute to Siobhan Dowd. Mm-hmm. And as well-meaning as that would have been, that's not a story. And it's not what she would have written. So a story has to come first, but that isn't abrogation of responsibility. It's things concern me, and things mm-hmm. I feel things, I feel deeply about certain things, as we all do.
Yeah.
And I have to trust that a story that I'm really dying to write, a story that I really can't wait to get back to, mm-hmm. is going to have all those things in it. And this one, that feeling that because a bad thing has happened, that nothing good will ever happen again,
yeah.
is a terrifying bit of being young. And it concerns me, and the story felt there. So I didn't set out to write a a lesson, but I did feel like I had to tell the truth. If this was what it was going to be about, it had to be clear and obvious. And not obvious, but couldn't lie about it, because you can tell when a writer lies.
So do you try not to censor yourself when you deal with that sort of thing?
I try not to censor myself, no. Okay. But again, that sounds like... I hate the implication in the censorship question, which comes up a lot, is that if there weren't censors, we would all just write pornography. And that's, you know, that's not true.
No, I don't think so. But
you have to tell the truth in a story to a teenager, because what are they looking at on the internet? What are they already experiencing and thinking about in their mm-hmm. lives? And if you don't address those issues, then you're abandoning them to face it by themselves. And to me, that's the immoral thing. So I don't censor myself, but neither do I just do it for a gratuitous thing. Because you can tell, that's a bad story. That's a bad story. And who wants to read a bad story?
Still on the sort of issues theme, More Than This is, I think, your first novel to feature a gay relationship in it. And one of the really nice things about it is how gently it's introduced into the storyline mm-hmm. and how much of a non-issue it is actually for the primary character, even though it, you know, causes issues for surrounding characters.
Yeah.
Was that like an active attempt to create more diverse representation in your book?
That is a fantastic goal, and it's very, very good. It's not a story. If you start a story saying, I want to do X, Y, and Z, you're going to be writing X, Y, and Z, you're not going to write a story. Mm-hmm. But again, these things, I care about these things, mm-hmm. so I'm going to respond to a story that has them in them already.
Yeah.
Cart and the horse type thing. But it is another philosophy of mine, that one of the ways to change the world is to pretend that the world has already changed.
Yeah.
And so I did like, and it's not my first book to have a gay couple in it. If you pay close attention to Knife of Never Letting Go, Todd's parents.
But that's so hilarious, because that is the sort of thing that happens, isn't it? Is you write them in and the world will just correct itself mm-hmm. in your perceptions, and you'll be like, oh yeah, well, they're just two men that live together.
Exactly. And and I think that's funny. And in book three of the trilogy, 1017, the third narrator, in two sentences, he has talked a whole book about his one in particular, and in two sentences someone else says, you loved him, and he says, yes, I loved him, and on we go. And so that to me is important. For it to be the central issue feels like you're pathologizing it, and it's kind of like, well, who wants to read about a pathology? They want to read about real life, and they want to read about real tenderness and real intimacy.
Yeah. But I think showing that real tenderness and real intimacy with, you know, minority groups of any kind, but, you know, with LGBT representation is really valuable, especially in young adult fiction.
I agree.
Because you are normalizing it. You're just saying, this is part and parcel, this is normal, everyone feels this way, and it's going to make big changes.
Very much agree. And that was the whole point of the scene between Seth and Goodman. It was not about the physicality of it. And I knew that as I was writing it, I thought, what's important is not, you know, what they're doing, although you can't be coy about that, because that's just stupid.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's not about that. No, not at all. Not at all. But it's about intimacy.
Yeah.
And it's about tenderness. And that, I thought, that's... If people get uncomfortable, they'll be uncomfortable because of the tenderness.
Oh, that was my favorite bit of the whole book.
Exactly. And I thought, screw that. This is important to me. So,
So now we've got a few questions about your writing.
Okay.
Obviously, I feel like you've been a big name for quite some time now. You know, you've won the Carnegie Medal twice. Mm-hmm. That people often forget that you had to start somewhere. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, like, how you got started as a writer.
I didn't think you could make a living as a writer when I was growing up, it's always important to me to tell young people when I visit the schools and things that it's possible. But I wrote anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of self-determination, I think, is the most important trait in a writer. If somebody tells you can't write, you write anyway.
Yeah.
Somebody tells you you're never going to make a living at it, you write anyway. Mm-hmm. And then I got my first book published in 2003, which was an adult novel called The Crash of Headington. Mm-hmm. It's all surprise. And then publishing a book is such a privilege. I don't ever want to take it for granted. The only books that I give bad reviews to are when I think the writer has taken a reader for granted.
Okay.
And so I'm always worried about getting stale. I'm always worried about being too comfortable. And so I like to try to find things that are scary, and scare me in a good way. The trilogy was massive and absolutely terrifying, and it was a 3-year scream. Then Monster Calls is completely different. I have to do something completely different because I have to challenge myself. And then More Than This is different again, but I did that while I was writing an adult novel, which was different again.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written a screenplay for Monster Calls, so it's all about just trying to keep myself challenged. I don't ever want it to be easy, because when it's easy, it's probably rubbish.
And are you working on any more fiction just now?
Yep, I'm just, in fact, it's a Thursday as we record this, and I will probably finish the first draft of the next book on Saturday. So, and it's a teen book, and then I'll do a second draft, obviously, but in fact, I finished the penultimate chapter on the plane here. Well, we had a huge delay, so I thought, right, so I just got on my notebook, and I've got an idea for a book after that, but we'll see. Easy. Don't pin me down. No.
I won't hold you to it. You just mentioned that you wrote on the plane on a notepad. Do you always write on a notepad?
Not always. I tend to write on a laptop. I'm a very fast typist. But sometimes I like to slow myself down on purpose. And so I've written a lot of this new book, most of it actually, by hand. I just wanted to slow it down. It's a different feeling. It's a different kind of... It's not so plot driven. In fact, it kind of makes fun, but it's slightly satirical about plotting, and that's an enjoyable thing. But I wanted to slow myself down. So it's more just again another challenge.
Patrick Ness, everybody. Thanks to him for making the time to talk to us, and of course thanks to Sasha for grabbing that interview. More Than This is available everywhere, and of course if you want to follow Patrick Ness on Twitter, you can follow him at Patrick_Ness, and if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at ScottishBKTrust. You can also find us on the Facebook or visit our website. There's loads and loads of things on there. We're at www.scottishbooktrust.com. I'm really pleased to share this conversation with Mikey Cudahy with you. We had a great chat about her book, A Conversation About Happiness. And it's her story about her childhood at Summerhill. Summerhill, for those of you who don't know, kind of a free Lord of the Flies-like school where the children made the rules is kind of how it's described. You're going to really like Mikey. You're going to love this interview. Here she is, Mikey Cudahy with A Conversation About Happiness.
My name's Mikey Cudahy, and my book is called A Conversation About Happiness, and it's a memoir. I've written it in the first person present, so it starts in the voice of a 9-year-old child. Myself and my brothers and I are looking at a woman lying in a coffin who looks like a waxwork, and it's actually my mum, who was killed in a car accident when I was 9. And my father died 4 years before in his own car accident. And we were then adopted by an uncle who was a sort of radical child psychologist. And kind of he decided he would send us all to England to experimental schools. So 3 of us went to Summerhill School in Suffolk. And my older brother and sister went to Kilwanity School in Scotland. And then my uncle pissed off back to America, basically, and we hardly saw him. A lot of it set in Summerhill, various encounters with A.S. Neil. And when we arrived there in 1962, he was almost 80. So we arrived, these kind of bewildered American kids, you know, with shorts and chocolate ice cream stains down our shirts. That was it. You know, that this island of damp crisps and salad cream.
For people who don't know what Summerhill means, can you tell us?
Summerhill was set up by A.S. Neil in 1921 in Germany. And his approach to child rearing, he felt that happiness was paramount for children. And for children to be happy, they needed to be free and self-governing. They needed not to be punished or taught to hate or to be sexually repressed. You know, they were all wonderful ideas. But we arrived, there was this sort of lack of structure, I guess, and a sense of kind of neglect. But that wasn't necessarily Neil's fault. And of course, we didn't have any parents, you know. So we would stay at the school in the holidays or be farmed out to people as paying guests. I'm now playing a violin in the background to make it so, you know, it was, and kind of arriving as Americans in this England which still had a sort of tinge of kind of post-war about it.
Because happiness is such a strange thing, especially when you tell people you should be happy. If you don't feel happy, then it creates the opposite effect and creates a profound amount of depression and confusion about that that depression. And do you remember having to going through that process? Were you aware as a young person that you were in a place that was supposed to be, I guess, idyllic?
Not really. I think the happy thing has only really come up through the years. I've done quite a lot of reading about Neil and his philosophy, you know, and he talked about happiness a lot. And also, when I tell people I went to Summerhill, people who've heard of Summerhill, they always ask me, were you happy there? And I'm always kind of lost for words, because I guess this was, Summerhill was like family, you know, Summerhill became our family. And we'd had quite a chaotic upbringing up until then as well, before my mother had died. You know, we'd had a very chaotic lifestyle with parents who were divorcing and remarrying, and there were custody battles and, you know, lots of violence and, you know, just a lot of craps sort of going on. So in fact, those 6 years I spent at Summerhill were quite 6 years of kind of constancy.
A form of tranquility, I guess.
Yes.
Do you have a very good memory, very vivid memory of that time period? Was it difficult to get into the voice of being a 9-year-old? It's such a hard thing to do, and it's such a long time ago, but then again...
Yeah, it was a real learning curve for me, actually, because when I first started writing the book, I was actually focusing on... It was sort of semi-fictional. I was writing about a young female artist who was living in East London in the 1980s, i.e. me, and changed everyone's names, you know. And it was, first it was she was, and then it was I was. And then I thought, oh, well, I should write something about her childhood. So I wrote about Summerhill, but changed everyone's names, and it was still she was. And then I found an agent who really, really liked the book. She said, but the childhood bit is actually a lot more interesting, you know. And I kept saying, no, you know, it's the 80s and the you know, and but it slowly kind of dawned on me that actually it was the childhood that held more interest. And after a year with this agent, we parted company amicably, because at that point I decided I wanted to write a memoir, and I had a piece published in the Observer magazine a couple of months later about my time at Summerhill, and the response I had for that was so positive. You know, I thought, okay, I'm going to carry on with this. And I went back and looked at my manuscript and started writing in the first person present. And that really helped place me back at Summerhill. I am here. Okay, here I am. And also conjuring up kind of conversations. I've always thought I was really bad with dialogue, but no, it's great. It's almost like having a seance, almost. Like you're thinking, okay, what was everyone saying in 1968? You know, what were my brothers arguing about? Okay, let's think about this. And then it would just kind of arrive, you know, this kind of dialogue, you know, would turn up.
Did you keep diaries or journals that you could reference, or was it all just in your head?
No, I use photographs a lot. There was a wonderful book that was published a year after we arrived at Summerhill by this brilliant American photographer called Herb Snitzer, and he wrote a book called Living at Summerhill. And that's really the only thing I have that kind of represents a family album, actually, because I don't have any family photographs from my childhood. But that year that Herb was at Summerhill, he took a lot of photographs, so I use those as prompts. There are two documentaries about Summerhill that I watched, you know, that so I used a lot of imagery, actually, and entered the past through that, and also letters. So I'm a real saver of letters. They're incredibly important.
Were there any parts of the book that were harder to access, you know, memory-wise, than you expected?
Yes, because once I signed with the brilliant agent I'm with now, I actually love her. I just think she's great. And she had, you know, heard of Summerhill. She was really interested in Summerhill, really interested in families and relationships. She lived in America. She was quite academic, but also very interested in writing, you know. There was one point where she said, well, how about your siblings? You know, how are they feeling? How did you relate to them? And I found that quite hard, actually, kind of, you know, how was my little brother feeling? I had to phone them. I had to talk to them. We wrote. In a way, it's been a good way of getting the family to kind of talk about their experience of that time. And my sister, who's older than me, she's always filled me in on things. But even when I was writing the book, she would suddenly kind of produce a letter that my uncle had written her in 1976 with an incredible revelation in it. And I think, why haven't I seen this before? Why didn't you show this to me before? Oh, well, I didn't think of it at the time, you know, with this sort of incredible information, you know. So in a way, the book, I felt when I was writing the book that I was kind of being my own researcher, or kind of researching this family and trying to piece everything together, you know, everyone's story, while still keeping it in the first person, you know, so I am here, you know.
Mikey Cudahy, everybody. You can get a copy of A Conversation About Happiness from fine bookstores everywhere. Next up, we have John Gordon Sinclair. You probably know him as an actor, but he also writes novels, and he's got this book called Blood Whispers, which I really enjoyed, and it was such a pleasure to talk to him about the novel. Here he is, John Gordon Sinclair.
Hi, my name is John Gordon Sinclair. The title comes from a quote from Hermann Hesse. I have been and still am a seeker, but I've ceased to question the stars and books, and I'm now listening to the message my blood whispers to me. He was quite well known as a manic depressive, and he was always looking outside himself for the meaning of life and stuff, and then he kind of came to this realisation that he should be listening to his own instincts rather than looking elsewhere for the answers. And that's the kind of main theme of the central character in the book, a girl called Kira Lynch, a lawyer working in Glasgow. There was something that happened to her when she was 8 years old in the early 90s that kind of informs who she is and why she's a kind of complicated and rather complex character, and why she feels this need to help people, which she thought she could do, she could realise by being a lawyer.
It sprawls out massively from there. I don't know, do you want to tell people more about how big this universe is? Because it isn't just a lawyer in Glasgow, it is...
Yeah, well, the first book, 70x7, was set in Northern Ireland and in Tuscaloosa and Alabama, and it kind of jumped between the two.
Of course, yeah, Alabama and Northern Ireland.
Well, it's the name, you know, you only have to say Tuscaloosa once, and you get it singed into your brain forever, and you want to say it all the time. You'll find yourself this afternoon saying Tuscaloosa and thinking that's a pretty cool name. The events that happen in that book, in the first book, when this girl is 8 years old, as I say, that informs who she is. She's representing a young girl who's been trafficked from Kosovo for prostitution. So there's a section of the book that happens in Kosovo. The CIA become involved as well. So there's stuff from Langley in West Virginia, where the CIA headquarters are. It's not a story about Glasgow. It kind of spreads out all over, as you say.
So just going back to this idea of listening to your blood, I thought it was really interesting just the way the book opens up, where you have Karen talking about this incident, which we won't reveal on the podcast, that happened when she was 8, and the therapist is asking, what do you think this will do for her? And she said something, I believe the line was, it'll fill the empty spaces. You know, it's not going to be about solace. And that goes back to that following what's in your blood, but also does that have some kind of resonance for you? Because I read it as a writer thinking, oh, that's what we write for.
I think that's true. I have experienced that feeling of, because it starts off, she's asking this psychiatrist or psychologist, I always get them mixed up. She has this thing that happens to her where she wakes up in the middle of the night and reaches out for someone who's not there. She has this kind of sense of longing for something, but she doesn't quite know what it is. And I've experienced that myself. I've had that same kind of feeling, and I think, I wonder what it is that's missing. I thought it was a good way of getting into her character, starting off with this sense of loss and longing, because her father, she doesn't have a father. It starts off with this conversation with the psychiatrist saying, you know, have you ever come across this before, this emptiness that you feel, and I want to find out what this emptiness is and kind of get rid of it.
Yeah, and wants to talk about it, but at the same time there's this horrible dichotomy where she doesn't want to talk about it either.
Yeah, she's got to a point in her life where if she actually does talk about it, then she would be admitting that it actually happened, and she's still not quite ready to do that. You know, she feels that if she says the words out loud, then she would have to admit to herself that these things that happened to her really did happen. So, you know.
Yeah. Does this tie in at all to, and I'm reluctant to take somebody's book and then put their kind of life or personal history in it, but I was reading you talking about acting, because you're also an actor and you've been in things like World War Z, and God, how am I going to forget Gregory's Girl? But you were saying that writing felt right and felt like what you should be doing. And are you listening to your own blood, do you find? Is this you talk? Is there a little bit of you talking to yourself?
That's a really good question, because I've just been offered I'm starting a job in the West End, and it's the most difficult decision I think I've ever had to make, because if I was listening to what my blood was whispering to me, I would have turned it down, and just because I've got a third book to write. And that's all I want to do, really, because I know that I've found something that I want to do, because everything that I've done so far has purely been for the experience. Because, if someone says to you, you want to climb a mountain, you think, yeah, well, I'll give it a go. I'm not necessarily a mountain climber, but the experience might be good. Or, do you want to parachute out of a plane? I want to try everything once. I want to tick the box of everything in life before I die and think, well, I had a go at it just for the experience. I've kind of always struggled with the acting thing, because I've never felt like... I originally, when I left school, I started out life as an electrician, and I kind of see myself as sort of an electrician with an imagination, really. I don't see myself as an actor at all.
When you were talking about, an electrician with an imagination, one thing I thought that was really interesting about this is, you're using a lot of different characters. I mean, you're a novelist. And I thought, well, what are the links between the creative process of an actor and a novelist? I guess in acting, you might, tell me if I'm wrong, if I'm going way out on a limb, but in acting, you have to inhabit somebody else's skin. You have to be somebody else. Mm. Here, you get total control. It must be quite an amazing thing. So I think I started to connect these things when I was reading about and thinking about your female protagonists and the fact that you have so many strong female protagonists. And as an actor, you would never obviously get to do that unless you were, recast in Tootsie or something. But you know what I mean? Like, there's this. It seems like there's a link there, and like almost acting just isn't enough of you in somebody else's skin. You get in a novel, you get to do and be empathetic and understand a wider range of characters.
Yeah. My approach to it is I've done big parts in small films, and I've done small parts in big films. So I know what it's like to be one of the sideline characters, and when I'm writing, I want to give them just as much attention and focus as the main characters, and so that they are more real than just an incidental character. Also, because sometimes when you do that, you suddenly come up with a character you think, I want to... And that's kind of what happened with Keira Lynch. She was a minor character in the first one, but because of what happened to her, I thought that would be a great way to tell the next story. And there's a character in the second book called Jago, who's a drug addict. He's on that point where he could actually just overdose and die. Or because I've kind of put a lot of kind of effort into him, I want him to be the focus in a book as well. And I'm already thinking that he might end up working with Keira Lynch at some point, and if I can get him through the drug rehab. But I never set out with that idea originally, but because of putting so much attention onto the smaller characters, you kind of end up having people you think, well, actually we want to spend a bit more time with them and develop their stories even further. Mm-hmm. And the other side is that in my head, I'm always trying to describe the movie that's playing in my head. I think in movie terms when I'm writing. And I've had conversations with my editor where I've said, in scene 14, do you think that's... And she says, no, do you mean chapter 14? I say, oh yeah, sorry, I mean chapter 14. I didn't mean scene. I mean chapter. And one, another sort of slight layer on top of that is, with crime fiction, I've read quite a few books, and I do like it as a, it's the kind of thing I want to take on holiday with me. But in a lot of instances, I've never empathised so much with a character that it's made me want to cry. And that's another element that I thought I want to really get. If you read my book and you don't cry, then I haven't achieved the task that I set out to do. I want you to have tears running down your face at one point, at least, throughout the book.
And to have a moment of real visceral experience, I guess, yeah.
Well, yeah, well, I think I remember having an argument with someone about going... We went to the movies, and when we came out, he was saying, like, I didn't enjoy it. It was so manipulative. And I think, well, that's why I'm here. I'm here to be manipulated. I feel if I'm not being manipulated, it's not doing a good job. And I could see it was a slightly deeper point than that. He was, it was just a bit too obviously manipulative. But I have the same thing in books. When I read a book, if it's meant to be funny, I want to laugh. If it's meant to be dramatic, I want to be, gripping have white knuckles. And if it's meant to be sad, I want to feel my eyes pricking and have a tear running down it. Because generally I go for the big Hollywood moment and then kind of cut it down to make it a bit more real. And there's a couple of moments that I've slightly missed in the second book, which are kind of, I think that's the big Hollywood moment, and I wish I'd pulled it back a little bit.
There's some really powerful moments in terms of, especially like, I think some of the stuff that's happening in Kosovo, it's very incredibly evocative and human, and you get a real sense of the place and these characters. How did you come to land on setting part of the story there?
I was trying to find a way of how the drug trade influenced or worked in Scotland, and how what the drug route into Scotland was. And I read this account of the Kosovoan kind of drug gangs that were starting to, you know, set up, and a lot of the established criminals and drug gangs didn't like to deal with them because they were too aggressive. Because they were all battle hardened, these guys, you know, they've come from a war zone, and so their attitude to violence is very different to guys that are just you know like street criminals, really. And I just thought it was really interesting, you know. And when the more I read into it and read about Kosovo and kind of the things that the easy kind of violence over there, simply because these guys are just off the battlefield, I thought it was a kind of interesting area to explore.
I think that's such a wise thing to focus on as well. That idea that their notion of somebody's notion of violence can be completely different than here. You know, just having survived in massive war zone, and you see that in the main antagonist. He's quite savage, but it's, you know, there's that trauma that he's lived with.
Yeah, and very smart. A lot of them are really, really smart, but their approach to violence, and it's quite funny, because one of the things was like these established crime gangs complaining, you know, that you can't deal with these guys. You know, anyone else, if the drug deal goes wrong or somebody's not giving you the supply, you can have a conversation about it and sort something out, but these guys just start shooting, and you know, and they were moaning about it, you know, moaning that there's kind of, they've lost some kind of, I don't know, moral standing.
Well, that whole honour amongst thieves, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I thought it was an interesting area.
John Gordon Sinclair, everybody. The book is Blood Whispers. Thanks to John for sitting down with us. John, as he was saying, wants to do more writing. Even a professional writer wants to do more writing. And if you happen to be not a professional writer yet, but you want to focus on your writing and learn more about the career of writing, the Scottish Book Trust has opened right now the New Writers Awards for 2015. You can apply to win an award for fiction, poetry in English and Scots, children and young adult fiction. The deadline is the 5th of September, and you're going to want to apply because you receive £2,000 in cash, as well as invaluable mentoring from industry professionals and writers, training in performance and presentation. It's a really, really rare opportunity, and it's one of the greatest things I think that the Scottish Book Trust does. Again, that's the New Writers Awards for 2015. They are ready for applications right now, and the deadline is the 5th of September. That's Friday, the 5th of September. Get your applications in, and good luck, everyone. Thanks to everybody who appeared on the podcast today. That's Patrick Ness with Sasha DeBoul, Mikey Cudahy, and of course, John Gordon Sinclair. Thank you for listening. Take the podcast out of your ears just now. And if it's a nice day, which hopefully it is, you should probably go outside, maybe take a book with you. We'll be back in yours very, very soon. Goodbye for now.